This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Shell. Today we're interviewing Denver Holt. He's president of the Owl Research Institute in Charlo, Montana. Today, the Owl Research Institute is one of the premier owl research centers in the world. Denver has published numerous scientific papers. He's a widely published author. He's been featured in many articles from the National Geographic to the New York Times, as well as in many television programs. He's educated and entertained people from all walks of life. So welcome, Denver. It's great to be talking with you. How'd you get started looking for owls? It requires getting up early in the morning. It's too early for me.
Yeah, and late at night as well. I was a young guy at the University of Montana taking an ornithology class, and one of the students came in and said his dad had seen an owl in a hole in the tree and thought it was nesting. So a buddy of mine and I went up there, and we found two different species nesting in the same tree thanks to this kid and his dad. And, you know, it was kind of fascinating back then, and there weren't a lot of owl researchers, and everybody was pretty much doing eagles and falcons and wolves and bears. So we decided to do a study, Billy and I. We skipped most of our classes. We sat there, took notes. We were juniors, didn't know what we were doing, and that was the beginning of it. Published two little notes on our observations, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of owl researchers back then. There's still not a lot today, so I kind of carved out a little niche for myself.
That was quite a while ago. You've had the Institute going for 30 years, right?
Correct, yes, 30 plus, I think.
Where did you graduate? And did you graduate in wildlife studies or what?
I guess I graduated in history with wildlife, you know, but history was my major to start with. When I switched to wildlife.
So how did the Owl Research Institute get started? Was it in Charlo, or did you start somewhere else and move to Charlo?
Started in my basement in Missoula, and like so many basement businesses, I learned very early on that even if I was lucky enough to get a job in wildlife after school and all that, that my opportunities to be in the field, being a field researcher, were pretty slim. And you could see that. I don't mean to, belittle anybody, but I could see that. You know, my professors, they hardly ever went out in the field, and the agency biologists that I worked with hardly ever went out in the field. And I just wanted to be a field researcher. And I messed around for a while, you know, part-time jobs with all the agencies and all that. And then one day, you know, I was working for a nonprofit, and I said, oh, this might be the way to go. There's a little more opportunity here, a little more flexibility. So I started the Owl Institute with just more guts and brains, and here we are 30-plus years later. And you don't like to say you're the top or anything like that, but one of the things I like to say is that we're probably one of the most active owl research groups in the world because we do it for a living. You know, it's a year-round process.
Right. So how did you get funding for it? You can't work for free.
I did for a while there. I started out just, you know, piecing together, you know, a few hundred bucks, a few thousand dollars, here and there, you know, got like local grants, and then finally we got a few people interested in what we were doing and, you know, the mission. And I think from what I understand talking to people, they pretty much just bet on me early on because I had all that enthusiasm and energy. And so that's grown into now, you know, we get research grants, we have a big constituent base, and we have matching grants, and we have, you know, a fair-sized budget. And we've provided the opportunity for young biologists to be field researchers for those that want to, you know, to be a field researcher. It's kind of tough. So, that's how we raise our money. Once a year, we put out a really nice newsletter and give our pitch, and then we try to match it, and we have some pretty good sizable matching grants that we try to do every year.
Yeah, well, you've got a staff of people who work for you, where you have 3, 4, 5 people.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good, you know, and like I said, I'm providing, an opportunity for, young biologists instead of just being stuck in a desk all your life, and I don't mean to be too tough on that, but most biologists end up behind the desk, and if they do go outside, it's usually only for a few weeks here and there. So I just provide this opportunity. The kids love it, and a small staff loves it. We're able to make a living out of going out in the field and doing wildlife research.
So let's talk about owls. How many species of owls are there here in this country or even worldwide?
Yeah, it varies. It's changed a lot since I was young. From, let's say, 125 or 30 species in the world. And now with molecular techniques and new surveys and vocalizations, let's say somewhere between 260, 270 species in the world. And that changes almost, every other year or so. But quite a few species than we previously had thought. And then in the United States and Canada, I'll leave Mexico out for the moment, but in the U.S. and Canada, there's roughly 19, maybe 20 species. It kind of depends how you break the pygmy owls up and perhaps the screech owls in the future. And then in Montana, I was just kind of lucky to land here. There's 15 species of owls which occur in Montana, of which 14 species breed, and makes Montana the number one state for the number of species breeding in your state. So that's kind of neat. That was just fortuitous.
Well, do you ever leave Montana and look for owls elsewhere?
Yeah, we have a big project, a major project in Alaska, the snowy owl, and that's the longest breeding season study of snowy owls in the world. I'm getting ready next month to go up there for my 33rd or 34th year, maybe. And so we have that project. We have a number of projects in Montana, as you say, but we've also been down into Central America quite a bit and help train people for doing nocturnal surveys for owls and, the best methods to locate them in the tropical forest, which is quite difficult. We've sponsored some research over in Kenya and Serbia. There's another one. I can't remember what the other one is. Over in Europe there. So sometimes we get them some research funding. Sometimes we get them equipment, which seems to be more important. And then just recently we helped sponsor a Nepal Owl Festival for their research awards for their young students that go out in the field. And that was kind of a new thing for us and kind of neat. And so our presence is kind of widespread. Our research is more narrowly focused to Montana, Alaska, with some stuff in Central America. We're trying to open it up a little more for the tropical forest owls and help participate and or contribute to research in those areas.
Your website indicates that you have conservation projects for 4 species, snowy's, long-eared, great gray, and short-eared owls. Why these species are selected out?
It kind of depends. The snowy owl and long-eared owls are 2 of our really long-term projects. The long-eared owl is 37 to 38 years this year. Snowy, 34 maybe this year. Short-eared, off and on 40-plus years. And the great gray is a new project. And with the snowy, it's about the Arctic, and it's about, a changing climate in the Arctic and how that affects prey species, which are lemmings, in turn snowy owls. With long-eared owls, they're kind of an overlooked species, and so we don't know a great deal about them, and it's really the only long-term study, certainly in the United States, on those species there. And the short-eared owls, the grassland species, we all know that, grasslands and shrublands are, they've kind of been declining at a pretty quick rate. And then the great gray owl, it's a newer project that we started. While we have some conservation concerns there is their nest sites. We think that they're somewhat dependent on big old broken top trees for nest sites. And so that's more of a conservation of old snags and, kind of mixed older forests. But that also kind of rolls into our conservation projects on just dead trees in general. We kind of like to say old trees for owls. So many of the smaller species depend on cavities, either made by woodpeckers or natural holes in trees, and then something as large as a grake or owl needs kind of broken tops, but it can also nest and stick nests. So they're all conservation projects. Some just maybe have a little higher priority.
So the habitat where you find owls is mostly forest land?
Well, I think the species diversity is greatest in the forest, as you would expect, and as you move south to the equator, where you have the highest species with the most diverse habitats. But, you know, the snowy owl, and the short-eared owl are kind of open country species, you know. So you have tundra nesting species and grassland nesting species. So, again, it kind of depends on the habitat, but just because it's not a diverse habitat doesn't mean it's not important. You know, the Arctic has few species of, you know, animals in general, but it doesn't mean it's less important than, say, the tropical forest, which has many species.
Is there a season where owls are more abundant in various locations, or are they seasonal, or are they ubiquitous year-round?
Yeah, you know, it kind of just depends on the species on that question there. You know, for example, the snowy owl may be, you know, common up in the Arctic in certain areas during the breeding season, but we don't often see a ton of them. So they're kind of seasonal when they migrate south, and every once in a while they have large numbers, what we call eruption migrations, where they've had a good breeding year, and a number of young birds migrate south on their first journey there. So that's more seasonal. Something like a great horned owl, for example, that most people in Montana are familiar with, they tend to be resident species year-round, so we always hear them hooting in the distance. Everybody knows the great horned owl hooting. Long-eared owl, short-eared owl, they're kind of like a come-and-go species. If prey species like voles are abundant, then these birds are, you know, somewhat nomadic or highly migratory. If they find hot spots where there's a lot of food, they'll stop and stay and breed, and then they may be gone the next year.
So do snowy owls change their plumage through the year?
Yeah, but it's not like they turn brown and white. You know, the way it works is that when they hatch out, they're all kind of, you know, a white base with, you know, heavily marked bars and spots. And as they age a little bit here, there's a difference in the colors between sexes. So just for the sake of simplicity, males may take 4 to 5 or 6 years before they start losing all their bars and spotting and become predominantly fluorescent white. Whereas females, they lose the heavy, heavy barring as a young bird, but as they age, they maintain bars, and we think perhaps that's something to do with camouflage or perhaps thermal regulation, hard to say. But they're all heavily marked when they're young. Females losing some markings, but at the same time retaining most of them. Males losing most of the markings until they turn bright white. It's really the only species in the world where it's so distinct. Adult males and adult females are totally different looking.
So why are owls classified as raptors?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like always been that question out there. You know, raptors are, I guess, basically you would say that, you know, birds of prey that have, you know, talons for grasping prey and a strong hooked bill for tearing apart prey and eating it. And so we always look at the raptors as kind of like the diurnal ones and then the owls. It's always been said that way. Well, birds of prey and owls. But essentially, they're all birds of prey. They all have similar traits such as I said, you know, the talons for grasping, hooking prey, and then the strong decurved bills for tearing apart food.
There are two types of owls. I think I saw from your website. They're Titanidae and Strigidae. What's the difference?
Yeah, those are the families of owls. So the owls all fall under, in birds in general, you know, they fall under an order. So we have order at a higher level, and their owls are all under strigiforms. And then there are differences between the groups. So we used to say the barn owls and the bay owls were one family, the Titanidae, and then typical owls were the other family, the Strigidae, which does that mean they're atypical? But nonetheless, there's distinct differences in morphology between those species and some other traits. So the barn owls and the bay owls, maybe they represent, let's say, 25 or so species in the world, or more, 25 to 30. And then the rest of the species in the world, that 225 or 30 or so more species, those represent the typical owls, whatever that means. But they share traits within that group similar to each other, which are different from the traits of the barn owls and the bay owls. Thus, we have the two families, kind of like from a, you know, an evolutionary perspective. And the way those things have been classified, it just makes it a little bit easier, what we would call the, you know, typological, biological, phylogenetic concepts. So, two families, one order, two families, I think six subfamilies, which I don't think we need to get into.
Talk about consumption.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Let's talk about consumption. What kind of prey do owls eat?
Well, pretty much everything. You know, the only thing that we don't really have is a true carrion eater, like the vultures, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
But given the tropics and all that, and the smaller species of owls, so you can just say insects. For many of the tropical forest species, insects are important, particularly the smaller ones. And then, occasionally amphibians, reptiles, bats from time to time in some species. But for the most part, small to medium-sized small mammals is what a lot of the species tend to eat, especially as you move upscale in size. In somewhere like Montana, many of the species eat voles and mice and things like that.
They don't eat plants, though. There's no vegetation.
Not that I know of, no.
Okay.
And, I have a pretty good handle on it. Every once in a while you get something comes up. We say, oh, I didn't know that. But for the most part, no vegetation and no carrion eaters.
And how do they go about hunting? Are they pretty much the same among different species?
Yeah, again, it's species dependent, but if you move into like somewhere like the forest, then most of the species in the forest are what we would say a perch and pounce. So they're sitting on a limb or some structure and just waiting for, motion or hearing or something like that to locate a prey and then glide down onto it. But other species, like you get in the open country, shorted owls and snowy owls, they may get on the highest perch they can find, whether it's a fence post if you're shorted or a tall mound if you're snowy. And then they use vision to sally out, chase it down. Or the short-eared, for example, might just quarter the ground, flying low over the ground, listen for acoustical cues, and then drop down and get prey. So it kind of just varies among the species, whether it's open country or forest, but they're just basically a few methods for hunting. Some will get up, like the snowy owl in Alaska, where the wind blows quite a bit on the tundra. It's a big, heavy owl, but if the wind's blowing pretty strong, it can fly up into the air and hover, just like a kestrel would, and hang into the air and hover and look down and hunt, and then, swoop, come back up on the other side, hang into the air, hover, look, and then swoop again to a new spot,
Do owls cache their food?
Some do, yeah. We're discussing that this morning with pygmy owls. We're trying to locate some nests, so the crew was discussing our next strategy to find this difficult nest. And one of it was if the female comes out and goes to the male and he gives her food, see if she brings it back to the nest or she goes and caches it. And sometimes they'll go cache it for later use. So not uncommon. In one snowy owl nest up in Alaska, for example, only females incubate and brood the chicks, and males provide the food and most of the nest defense. So the females are on the nest, and they're always, they always want more food. At one nest we found, I think it was 86 lemmings piled up in the nest. And you could say cache, they're just piled around the nest, and then as the chicks grow and the females need them, she'll feed them to the chicks.
And then they regurgitate from the food they've swallowed.
Correct, yeah. The undigestible materials, bone, feathers, fur, teeth, fingernails, and things of that sort. So they don't have really the strongest digestive enzymes like in the dino birds of prey. So they cast that pellet, you know, depends on the species and how much food, you know, so many hours in between meals. And actually it's pretty good for people like us because we can grab those pellets, dry them, and then dissect them and then look for the small mammal skulls or whatever's being eaten. And that gives us a pretty good idea of the diet of many of these species.
Can you identify the species by the form of the pellet?
You can up to a degree. You know, like a great horned owl has a pellet, you know, the size of your thumb, maybe a little bigger, and a solid owl has a pellet the size of the last digit on your little finger. And then, so that can kind of put you in the ballpark. But mostly what we like to do is take those pellets apart, look for the skulls. The bigger owls will swallow small mammal prey whole, like voles or lemmings or mice. And then the skulls are packed in the pellet, and we'll open it up. And just like if you burned up in a fire and they couldn't identify your body, but they could look at your dental record and identify you. It's the same thing. What we do is we take those skulls out, and then we can look at the dentition and the patterns on the dentition, the type of dentition, and identify exactly what's been eaten.
What's the mating behavior of owls?
We like to say the big ones are hooters and the little ones are tooters. So the owls have evolved, you know, kind of unique vocalizations so they can communicate at night or low light levels. And so there's hoots and toots and whistles and clacks and hisses and all that stuff. And again, depending on the species, as I did earlier, the great horned owl might go, hoo, 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 hoo. And the little solid owl, as big as your hand, might go. Like a truck backing up.
Yeah.
So, and that's basically, you know, it's made of traps. It has a lot of functions, but it really picks up at the onset of courtship, and it tails off quite a bit once a mate is secured and they begin nesting. And then, you know, your job switches from mate attraction to mate provisioning if you're the male.
So when and where do they nest?
Depends, again, on species. The smaller ones, you know, like in Montana, you know, pygmy owls and flaming owls and screech owls and saws and burials, they tend to be what we would call obligate cavity nesters, and so they need either old woodpecker holes or they need holes in trees, natural holes in trees, in order to nest because they don't build nests. That's why snags are so important as a conservation issue. And then the larger species like great horned or great gray may use stick nests that they take over from red-tailed hawks, for example, ravens. They may use mistletoe because they're so big that they need something big like that. They don't fit into most cavities. So, you know, there's exceptions, but for the most part. So it just depends on the size.
And some nests
on the ground or underground. The short-eared owl nests on the ground, and the burrowing owl is tied into primarily prairie dog colonies, and they nest under the ground in abandoned prairie dog or fox or something like that holes or burrows.
Do they all emit the same number of eggs, or is it different by species?
Yeah, again, species dependent. You know, something like, you know, short-eared owl, we just found a nest this year that had 9 eggs in it already. And then a great horn might have, you know, in Montana, basically 1 to 3, but usually 2 to 3. Although we do have an exception right now. We've got 5 chicks in one nest and 2 females that are on the nest, which we're trying to figure the genetics of this out. It's kind of interesting. But, it's very food-dependent, you know. And so more food, more eggs, less food, less eggs for many of the species, and the boom and bust. And then, you know, the resident species are going to be there all the time, something like the horned owls, 2 to 3, great gray owls, 2 to 4.
And what's the length of incubation?
Again, species dependent, you know, 25, 30 days in some of the smaller species and, you know, 30, 35 days or so in some of the larger species.
Do the eggs hatch simultaneously or are they staggered?
Yeah, they're staggered or asynchronous. It's usually the order in which they lay their eggs. And most of the time, if they lay their first egg, they'll incubate at least intermittently, but by the time they lay the second egg, they're totally committed to incubation. And then if they lay 3, 4, 5, 6 eggs or 8 or 9 or 10 eggs like in snowy owls, They usually hatch in the order laid. So you can have a little nestling that's 1 day old and then a sibling that's 10 or 12 days old in the same nest.
How long does it take chicks to fledge?
Species dependent again. You know, the like a shorted owl is kind of interesting. They nest on the ground. They're vulnerable to mammalian predators. And so their growth is super quick. So after they hatch at about 2 weeks of age, the young leave the nest on foot. All right, whereas, you know, a great horned owl up in a tree, big, powerful owl, capable of, you know, protect itself from almost anything, their chicks may stay in and around the nest 5 or 6 weeks before they start branching or climbing on the outer perimeter of the tree.
Uh-huh. What's the Montana Migration Project that you mentioned on your website?
Yeah, that's our solid owl migration project. The solid owl is a small forest owl for the most part, and it's known to have really significant migrations where, you know, I mean, tens of thousands of them have been banded over the years, maybe even 100,000s of them. And they tend to move south from their northern breeding grounds in, let's say, September, October, into early November. And they're attracted to vocalizations, their own vocalizations, for reasons I don't know if we all know, but that toot call that I did earlier will put a recorder out with that vocalization surrounded by nets, and then the owls that are migrating, for some reason, they come into that sound and they get hung up in our nets, and that's our migration project. But people have been doing that for a long time throughout the United States, and almost anywhere you put one of these stations up, you seem to catch these birds. They must be incredibly numerous.
And what's the winter raptor survey?
That's a neat project. It's about diurnal birds of prey primarily. And many, many, many years ago, myself and a few others have known that the Mission Valley was a really good place for wintering birds of prey. And it's been known by bird watchers forever. We started making observations, and, you know, we just found that there was a ton of birds here. And in the past 5 years now, one of our lead biologists, Beth Mendelson, her first task when we hired her 5 years ago or 6 years ago was to set up a survey method for the, you know, wintering birds of prey in the Mission Valley. Well, we just completed our fifth year, I believe it is. We run transects 5 months. So we start in November, December, January, February, March, once a month, 5 simultaneous transects at the same time, about 25 miles long, 5 groups. And this year we went over our 11,000 birds of prey that we've counted in the Mission Valley during winter. Yeah, in the Mission Valley. So pretty amazing. Might have some of the highest densities anywhere in northwestern United States, but perhaps the West. So that's a really, really neat project.
Well, Denver, I have a lot more questions to ask, but so if you'll hang on, we'll do another session. But I have to wrap it up for today, so thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Our guest today has been Denver Holt. He's the president of the Owl Research Institute in Charlotte, Montana. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org and listen to our other interviews. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.